This is the Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome into another edition of the Athletic Baseball Show presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. We hope your week's off to a great start with nothing but no hitters on the horizon. Also, a late happy Mother's Day to all the moms listening out there. We are recording the show on Mother's Day, so hope you had a great day. I'm Tim McMaster, along with Ken Rosenthal. As always, on Mondays, it's Ken's mailbag. We're going to get to the questions, but Ken, how are you doing?
Doing great, Tim, and I share your thoughts. I want to wish everyone, even though it's one day late, a happy Mother's Day and hope everyone has a great week. Let's get going.
Yeah, let's do it. And a couple of people not off to great starts to their weeks are some of the biggest stars in baseball. Jacob DeGrom left his start on Sunday, just five innings. Looked like it was that lat injury bothering him again, which is obviously better than an arm injury. And then you had the Braves and Phillies Saturday night, Ken. Ronald Acuna taking the pitch right off the hand on the bat. You hate to see that. X-rays negative, though, thankfully.
X-rays were negative, and you're right, thankfully, because it looked like it was much worse than it turned out to be, which was a left pinky contusion, which doesn't sound like much of a problem at all. We don't know going into tonight if he's going to play or not. We're taping this before the ESPN game, but certainly the Braves avoided a major problem. But that said, it's quite disturbing when pitchers go up and in the way they so often do today and are seemingly unable to control it. Now, we can debate whether Sam Coonrod was having that issue last night, but he threw two pitches to Acuna, both were up and in and out of the zone. And you have a problem now, and John Smoltz talked about this on the broadcast, where he said pitching inside never had the elevation behind it that it does now. When you match the velocity with the elevation, you're playing with fire. And John's right about this, and it's a problem. And I'll give you a stat that I read on the broadcast as well, and it's kind of telling. Ronald Acuna Jr. in his career has been hit 22 times in 344 games. Henry Aaron in his career was hit 32 times, just 10 more times for his entire career, in nearly 10 times as many games, 3,298. Now, it's not just the pitchers. Hitters do dive in more today, and maybe they're not as proficient at getting out of the way, but try getting out of the way of 98 coming at your hands. It's not so easy to do. I don't know what the answer is to this. John doesn't know what the answer to this is. No one seems to know what the answer is, but with the emphasis on pitching upstairs and the inability of pitchers now to seemingly control where the ball is going, we're going to see more of this. We've seen a lot of this, and it's no good. It's something that is really disturbing, and in this case, it looks like Acuna escaped serious injury, and that's great, but the fact is, this is going to happen again with him. He is someone that teams feel they need to go in on, and if you go in on him and you don't know where it's going, well, you get what you got last night.
Yeah, absolutely. Scary stuff, but luckily day-to-day, so hopefully he'll be back in the lineup. Maybe he is as we record this on Sunday night. The Braves did add some pitching, Ken, as well. They add Shane Green to the bullpen, and here's a guy. He was an all-star in 2019. Very good last year for the Braves. They bring him back, but crazy to me that he was unemployed until now.
Good point, Tim. This is a quality reliever, and yet he obviously wanted more than teams were willing to give him. Now, if you remember, the Braves last year had three relievers that they lost to free agency. Melanson was one. He's having a great year in San Diego. O'Day was another. He's been hurt with the Yankees. And Shane Green was the third. He was unsigned, of course, until today. And the Braves couldn't sign these guys because of pure payroll restrictions. They just couldn't give them the money that they needed. And it wasn't a lot of money. It was $3 million for Melanson, $3.15 million for Day. What Green got today is about $1.1, $1.2 million for the rest of the season. It's a $1.5 million deal prorated. So this should help them. And certainly with Shane Green, yes, you wonder why he was out there so long. The Angels actually had interest right before the season started. They thought something was going to get done, and it didn't. And instead, they went out and got Tony Watson and Steve Cishek. So you look at this now from the Braves' perspective. They've been very good and very deep from the left side of their pen. Will Smith, Minter, Matzik, Newcomb coming back. They've been a little bit weak on the right side with Chris Martin out. Now he's coming back too. He's on a rehab assignment right now. But with Green, once he gets into the mix, he's going to start at AAA. They should be much better off than they've been in recent days. They've been cycling through relievers, kind of trying to find answers with guys that wind up getting DFA'd pretty quickly. So this move, yes, it should help them.
All right, and one more thing before we get to the mailbag, and I joked about it right off the top, the no-hitters, which, I mean, you could say they're coming weekly. You're pretty much right, right? We're 5 weeks into the season. There's been four no-hitters, 2 in 3 days last week, including Wade Miley's.
Wade Miley is one of my favorite players, and he's one of my favorite players because he's one of the most relaxed guys you will ever meet, inside or outside of baseball. This guy is just laid back and cool, and I'll tell you a story. Goes back to game 2 of the 2018 NLCS. He started that game in Milwaukee against the Dodgers. Now, before a postseason game on Fox, the way we set it up, Joe Buck and John Smoltz kind of give the overview, and then they come to Tom Verducci and I on the field, and we speak for maybe, I don't know, 30 seconds each. It's timed, and it's tight, and it goes right up to the first pitch in many cases. On that day, with Wade Miley on the mound, waiting to begin arguably the biggest start of his life, we were late. And I'm standing there talking. He's on the mound. I'm right in front of the Dodgers dugout. Dave Roberts is screaming at me, kind of good-naturedly, but screaming. Other guys are throwing sunflower seeds at me. So after the game, I see Wade. He pitched really well. 5 2/3, I believe, no runs. And I talked to him about it. I said, hey, man, I am sorry. It was out of my control, but I'm sorry. He didn't have a care in the world. Now, if it was Max Scherzer or Kershaw or any number of other pitchers I could think, like 90% of them, they would have been ready to kill me. Wade Miley just went out and pitched his 5 2/3 scoreless, and that was that.
You just got to blame Joe Buck at that point, right? Because everybody else blames Joe Buck for everything, Ken.
That's true. Everyone does blame Joe. It wasn't Joe's fault. Our timing was just off for whatever reason. I don't even remember. But all I remember is I was very grateful that it was Wade Miley on the mound and not one of those other fire breathers.
Exactly. Let's move on to the mailbag.
Hey, this is Ken. I'm not available right now. Please leave a voicemail.
All right, you know how to get involved by this point. You can call us. You can use the voicemail line at 646-543-7072 or email the show, tabaseballshow@gmail.com. Either way, we'll get your questions to Ken. And Ken, this week we're going to start with some voicemail.
Hey, Ken, this is Daniel from Florida. Really love the show. Just wanted to ask if Albert Pujols' contract is literally the worst in baseball history. He collected about 5.7 WAR for $220.7 million over 10 years with the Angels. I think you have a good comparison with Mike Hampton. He had 2.9 WAR in 8 seasons and got $121 million with the Braves and the Rockies. Anyone else stand out for you in that competition?
Daniel, there is one other player that stands out. And if you want to call it a competition, it's not the most glorious of competitions. But that player is Miguel Cabrera, who very well could meet the same fate as Pujols at some point. He is signed through 2023. His original deal with the Tigers, or second deal with the Tigers, 8 years, $248 million. So he has this season and two more remaining. And right now, for that entire period, he's at 4.6 WAR. So that's even less than Pujols did over his 10 years with the Angels. Now, granted, it's fewer seasons, but it's not like Miggy's putting up 3 or 4 win seasons right now. They're negatives, and he's off to a horrible start as well. So people might say, okay, well, the lesson is never sign these guys long-term. I don't agree with that. There have been some good long-term contracts, surprisingly enough, with pitchers. Mike Mussina was one. Max Scherzer right now is another one. He has exceeded the value of his 7-year, $210 million deal, which had all kinds of deferrals in it as well. And I believe that we're going to see some of the younger stars who have signed contracts in recent years, Bryce Harper, Manny Machado, Fernando Tatis Jr., because they signed at a younger age, the teams will get more value out of those deals than they might have with Miggy or with Albert Pujols, who signed when they were in their 30s. So, yes, certain deals obviously are regrettable in the end. And in many cases, teams know they're going to be regrettable, but they want the front-end value. With Albert, you really never got that front-end value. That first season was a 3-win season. Okay, not Albert Pujols level. And from there on, it just wasn't good.
Those two guys, Pujols and Cabrera, those deals to me are fascinating to compare because when you look at them, Ken, right? Pujols went somewhere else to the Angels who gave him the money. The Cardinals sure wanted to keep him but didn't want to go that high. Whereas Cabrera is the opposite, where the Tigers, I think, felt like we have to keep this guy. He's one of our all-time greats. And then they gave him the big deal. So basically they went the extra step that the Cardinals wouldn't. So I guess if you're a fan of the Tigers, maybe you feel better about the Cabrera deal because of everything he did give your franchise, whereas the Angels fans kind of didn't get that from Pujols.
Well, that's the problem. That's right, Tim. And certainly, it's like Francisco Lindor right now. Mets fans don't care what he did in Cleveland. It's what are you doing for this team this year and beyond? That's it. And the Angel fans were in the same position. And Pujols did some great things in that uniform, 500 homers, 600 homers, 3,000 hits. But by and large, the last 4 years, not good.
All right, the next question, sticking with the Angels again.
Hi there, Ken. Huge fan of your work. My name is Jacob Richards. And my question for you is, with the approach that Shohei Ohtani has had on the mound and Joe Maddon's approach to when to pull him and how the rest of that pitching staff has been throwing, do you think that Shohei Ohtani pitching as frequently as he is and pitching as well as he is a sustainable plan for Joe Maddon and the Angels, potentially one to get them into the playoffs with their division? Thanks again. Have a good one.
Jacob, the beauty of Shohei Ohtani is there is no precedent. We really don't know what is sustainable and what is not. Now, the difference this season is they let him go. And when I say that, they are allowing him to pitch, allowing him to hit, and kind of allowing the whole Shohei experience to finally flower. Now, that was the plan, of course, when he came over, and that was the condition when he signed with the Angels or any other team that would have signed him. But a lot of people believed it would not be possible simply because of the difficulty of it. Clearly, we've seen now he is an incredibly athletic and strong physical specimen. He can do this. He can handle it. Now, how long can he handle it for? We don't know. And probably because he hasn't pitched that much coming off the Tommy John surgery, that he'll have to be restricted in the number of innings he throws. So they'll back off him at some point. But in terms of physical capacity, that's an ongoing process. And it's not something that we can have any firm conclusions on because it's just not known. So they're going to keep it going for as long as they can, I would imagine. They've got other problems as well. Quintana hasn't been good. Cobb's on the injured list. Their pitching problems are enduring, historic. And when I mean historic, I say historic as in annually. And it's just an issue for them. But with Ohtani, it seems to me that as long as they're in contention, they'll get the most out of him or try to within reason. They obviously do not want to hurt him.
And speaking of Joe Maddon, he's actually going to be on this show on Tuesday with Jason Stark and Doug Glanville. So definitely check that out. Joe joining the show, I think it's his return visit to Starkville. So that's going to be a lot of fun. Joe, obviously a great interview every time he's around. All right, next we go to email, Ken. This one from Adam Kane. He says, after John Means missed perfection by a drop third strike, I've heard some scrutiny over the drop third strike rule itself. Can you talk about your thoughts on the rule and its place in the game? Maybe you can channel your inner Jason Stark and talk about how changing the rule would change the game. Love the show.
Well, only Jason can change rules. He's the man. There's a Stark rule now, right?
Yep.
This is a good question, and it's come up a lot after the Means near perfect game. The rule is the catcher drops a third strike, runner has the ability to go to first base, and that's why it wasn't a perfect game. That's what happened. Catcher dropped the third strike, runner got the first base. Not perfect. So in terms of it being perfect, let's address that issue first. No, it wasn't. That's not how it works. It's got to be 27 outs in 27 batters, and it's got to be no defensive miscues at all. It's got to be perfect. It's a team accomplishment to some degree. Now, as for the rule itself, I don't mind it, but a lot of pitchers really can't stand it. And Max Scherzer, I believe, has called it the dumbest rule in the game. And Justin Verlander, after his 3,000th strikeout, I read this in his brother Ben's story on FoxSports.com. He had that exact thing happen on his 3,000th strikeout. Drop third strike, runner gets the first. And Verlander said, if my pitch is so bad that the guy swings at it and the catcher can't catch it, why is he allowed to go to first? That shouldn't be the case. And I can see that. And there have been a few moments in baseball history where the drop third strike has had a huge impact. 1941 World Series, Mickey Owen, Tommy Henrik, that whole deal. Even going back to 2005, the ALCS, White Sox Angels, A.J. Pierzynski, who was always in the middle of everything, he had one that actually wasn't a drop third strike, at least in my view. It was Josh Paul. I thought he caught the ball. A.J. got the first. The whole controversy erupted over that. But could baseball do without this rule? I believe baseball could do without this rule. But yet, the other day on MLB Network, it came up. I gave my opinion. And Bill Ripken, who is a student of the game, a former player, he would be a great coach if he ever decides to become one. He said, nope, that's part of the game. So kind of depends on your perspective.
And until Jason weighs in, we won't have any changes. That's for sure.
He's the man.
From an Adam on email to an Adam on voicemail.
Hey, Ken, this is Adam. Pitchers this season are on pace to shatter the no-hitters record, and we might even see 20 no-hitters the way this year is going. Do you think that the no-hitter could ever lose its historic sparkle and instead just become the reality of today's brand of baseball? Thanks a lot.
Adam, I like this question. I don't know that the no-hitter will ever lose its unique quality. It's a special day for a pitcher. There's no doubt about it. But let's play out your scenario. Let's say there are 20 this year. And the way this game is going right now, I don't know that you can rule it out with our 234 batting average and 24% strikeout rate. So I even thought this after the Miley no-hitter. I was like, great, but we just had one. And we've had a couple already. And we're going to have a few more, I guess. And it just didn't seem to have the same cachet. Now it does. To a pitcher, it's extremely special. And it's extremely hard to do. It takes luck. It takes, of course, skill. And in this day and age, it takes a relatively low pitch count, so the manager lets you pitch all nine innings. But it kind of speaks to this whole question in the game right now about the lack of offense. And the numbers are so bad. I just rattled some of them off. Things are going to have to change. We need more action in the game. And I know there are traditionalists out there saying, don't change the game. I like the game the way it is. That's fine. But every other sport seems to be able to change to put more offense in. I don't know why baseball can't do that. Baseball is looking at ways to do that. So if you want to make the no-hitter more special again, make it so it's more difficult to pitch again, and then we'll have a better conversation. It's still special. It's always going to be special. But if we end up, Adam, with 20 this season, like you project, and not unreasonably, that's an interesting conversation we're all going to have.
Yeah, at this point, it's still the thing where if you're on Twitter and you see that it's happening, people just change the channel and try to check out the game, even if it's not their team. It's still there. Let's hope it stays there and is that important. All right, next question comes from Ben.
Hi, Ken. This is Ben Fadden. My question for you is regarding the Padres bullpen. You said earlier this year that you believe the Padres are still one big reliever away from being right up there, you know, with the Dodgers. But if Mark Melancon continues to be the best closer in the league, like he is right now, and Drew Pomeranz stays healthy, and Tim Hill keeps getting out of big situations like this, and Emilio Pagan pitches well, and Craig Stammen keeps, you know, coming in and providing length, do you still hold that same view? Do you still think that A.J. Preller needs to go out and get another big reliever to really give the Padres a great chance to be in the World Series?
I'm just going to say that's a lot of ifs he just rattled off. Go ahead, Ken.
It is, but he makes a good point, too. And it kind of shows you the folly of any predictions at any point in any baseball season. And I did say what I said, because I thought ultimately Melancon fits better as the setup guy for the big ninth inning guy, be it Josh Hader, who we've talked about, or someone else. But Ben's point is well taken. Their five relievers, the names he rattled off, they've all been really good. Now, can Melancon sustain it for a whole season? I'm not sure. But we're talking about a bullpen that is first in the National League in ERA, fifth in opponents OPS in the majors, and with a very good strand rate as well. So they performed at an extremely high level. The problem is doing this over 162. And you will see teams, even with good bullpens, try to supplement at the deadline because, of course, depth, especially this season, is going to be critically important coming off the 60-game campaign in 2020. So Stammen and Hill have pitched a lot. Melanson is a little older. I still would like to see them get one more, if only for depth. Keone Keller just went on the injured list. And ultimately, at the deadline, obviously each team is going to need to assess its needs at that point. But while the Padres' bullpen needs might not seem as acute as they once did, talk to me in July. Let's see where we were then. But it's a good observation. No question, Ben. They performed really well.
All right. The next question actually came in right after that Dodgers-Cubs series last week with Cubs. So it's a little earlier, but I think it's still relevant with those teams and how they're playing right now.
This is Julio from Costa Rica, and I am a Cubs fan. I love listening to your show to start a week and every week. I have two questions based off of the last Dodgers-Cubs series. How long will it last for the Dodgers to bounce back after this series sweep and all these bad game streak that they are having right now? And how long will the Cubs last on during this lucky streak? Like, will they be able to bounce back and stay performing like this until postseason, a potential postseason berth?
Okay, Julio, let's take one at a time. The Dodgers first. Clearly, they are reeling. They've had an awful go of it of late. Finally had a big performance against the Angels, and maybe that will set them straight. But they lost Pollock over the weekend, too. So they've had injuries. They've had subpar offensive performance. Their bullpen is thin now as well. You're seeing a lot of names coming out of that bullpen that you do not normally see. I still expect them, as does everyone else in the sport, to be really, really good this season. Are they going to be 110 wins? Maybe not. But ultimately, the players will revert to their career norms in a good way, and they should be fine. The Cubs actually are more interesting to me because I'm not quite sure what to make of them. They came out of that Dodgers series, and to this point, entering Sunday, they've won five straight. And those were against the reeling Dodgers and 2 one-run wins over the Pirates. Their rotation ERA next to last in the majors entering Sunday, ahead of only the Rockies. They've been over five. It's no good. And they traded Darvish. They stuck with these guys who are softer tossers, and Arrieta has been hurt of late. So it's kind of all snowballed against them. But if Hendricks and Davies can get going again and they get more out of Alzolay, they could be okay. Their bullpen's been pretty good, middle of the pack. Offense, for all its early troubles, has also been kind of middle of the pack. So it's the rotation that is going to tell whether the Cubs can contend or not. And right now, they're right in the mix in the National League Central. So I don't rule them out, but I haven't seen enough to exactly rule them in either.
All right, let's go back to email. This one from Wayne Baker, and there's kind of a lot of different levels to this one, Ken. So I guess pay attention. So what is the perfect pitch clock time if MLB adopts this? Would 15 seconds be too little time? Maybe 17, maybe gradually phase in from 20 to 19 to 18 to 17 over several seasons. And then related, when should the pitch clock start? So, and then another sort of related question is, how do we get players to stay in the batter's box?
Well, to the last part of that question, forget it.
That's not it.
They've been talking about that for years, and it is yet to transpire where the hitters actually stay in the box, and no penalties seem to make a difference, Wayne. So let's not focus on that. Let's talk about the pitch clock, because this is something that I expect will be part of the next collective bargaining agreement. Though right now, it seems the union is opposed. Now, the time that they use in the minor leagues is 20 seconds. If you go shorter than that, you're risking more injury. You're risking some real problems, not enough time to recover between pitches. 20 seconds in the minor league seems to have been a relatively reasonable point. And when the clock begins is when the pitcher receives the ball back, when he's on the mound, he's got the possession in the dirt circle, and the batter's in the dirt circle surrounding home plate. The pitcher must begin his windup or begin his motion to come to the set position. That must happen within 20 seconds. Again, that seems to be a reasonable time frame and decent enough way to go. It has been used with runners on base. If you step off or you feign a pickoff, the clock starts again. How much of an impact will this have on the major leagues? I don't know. It seems to me, though, it's a good idea as far as pace is concerned, certainly. Now, there have been some points made to me by some people in the game that it actually might lessen the velocity question or reduce the impact of velocity because pitchers throwing more often or at a greater frequency will not be able to sustain this 99, 99, 98, 97 sequencing that they do now. I don't know that that's true. And again, there is a risk of injury, I guess, with the pitch clock. That would be one of the union's concerns. At the same time, it's one of any number of measures that should be adopted to get this game moving again. And I know people often say, man, you guys complain a lot about this game we love. But there are still things about this game we love that can be improved and make to the point where it makes the game even better. And that is all the people who talk about these things are trying to accomplish, whether it's Jason, whether it's John Smoltz, anybody who talks about baseball, Bob Costas. These folks, including myself, do not hate baseball. We love baseball, but we see the games every day, and we believe baseball can be better.
The next question is voicemail, and it's another person who thinks the game can be better as connected to the umpires.
Hi, guys. Thank you for the show. It's been so good recently. I asked a question about the Blue Jays a couple of weeks ago. Now I'm going to ask about something more league-wide. And I know this has been debated a lot and people are talking about it a lot, but when does MLB draw a line with the umpires making, you know, the wrong calls or the replay? And when do they draw a line and either start firing people or start to reiterate, you know, how the rules work?
This is a question on a lot of fans' minds. It seems every night, every other night, we have some kind of issue with the umpires, with replay, with something that doesn't involve the actual players themselves. I was reading an article today by none other than Jason Stark. 8 ways to improve umpiring. You know when that article was written? 2013. And I'm willing to bet that the Jason Stark of the 1950s, the 1960s, and the 1970s, right on through and all the way back, were writing similar articles. Now, you can't simply fire umpires because they are part of a union and they are protected to a degree by that union. Players often say, hey man, if I hit 180, I'm going to AAA. Why don't these guys get sent down? It does happen. And there are times when an umpire is sent back to the minors. There are even times when umpires are let go. But once an umpire reaches 3 seasons, at least it used to be this way, and I believe it still is, Major League Baseball is required to work with them to correct any issues they may be identifying. And they really can only be let go for repeated offenses over a long period. Problem with that is you get a group of umpires that essentially is older, and you don't get a turnover of people, fresh umpires coming into the game on a greater basis than is the case now. If you had more transition, you'd have a greater number of openings and perhaps a greater competition, I guess, for those jobs, the way you do with players. But I don't know that I see that changing anytime soon. And I must say, and I say this every time I'm asked about umpires or write about umpires, by and large, they do an amazing job. Really, they do. They miss maybe, I don't know, 1 out of every 50 calls, whatever the number is. It's not that high. And it goes for the guys working the plate too. So their mistakes obviously are quite apparent to all of us, especially when they occur in big situations. But I would advise or ask or politely request the fans take it easy on the umps too. They're professionals, and by and large, again, they do a great job.
All right, one more question. This one from Brad on the voicemail.
This is Brad Chandler. My question is what is the likeliness that MLB and the Players Association will agree on a designated hitter throughout the league?
Brad, we should have one this year. And it should have been adopted because we're in a situation now where there was a universal DH last season. There is not one this season. The pitchers, again, are hitting in the National League. And most likely next season, we will have a universal DH under a new collective bargaining agreement. Now, that's the key phrase, collective bargaining agreement. When you add something like a DH or change anything, there is a whole system of levers and other rules and other considerations that are also part of the equation. And when they talked, baseball and the union did, about adding the universal DH for this season, Major League Baseball wanted the exchange to be expanded playoffs. The union thought, well, expanded playoffs are worth a lot more than the universal DH. Sorry, we're not doing that. And that's ultimately a simplified but mostly accurate version of why it didn't happen this year. Once the collective bargaining talks begin in earnest, then you will see these things and the trade-offs discussed. Now, we might not learn of them until the very end. I don't know. But the DH won't be adopted unilaterally. It'll be adopted as part of this massive agreement that includes all of these other things as well. And the union wants it. MLB, for the most part, wants it too, but they're using it as a bargaining chip. So I do expect it to be part of the agreement and really forevermore. But it's going to have to be as part of this larger conversation.
It's going to be a fun off season, that's for sure. All right, great question. Great questions, as always. If you want to be part of the show next week, the voicemail line is 646-543-7072. You can email the show at tabaseballshow@gmail.com. And Ken, next week, you're actually going to be on the road again. It's exciting, and it's more exciting because you're going to San Diego. I'm jealous.
It's true. I can't complain about my first road assignment this year. San Diego is a great place, and looking forward to seeing the Padres in person as well as the Cardinals to be visiting the Padres. That'll be our FS1 game next Saturday night. And yeah, we'll be doing the show probably from the beach, Tim.
You'll be on the beach. I'll be in my packing up apartment with boxes everywhere, but I'll try to live vicariously through you. All right, we'll be back again next Monday. As for the rest of this week, you definitely want to keep it locked on this podcast. Coming up on Tuesday, as I mentioned, Joe Maddon joining Jason and Doug, then Hunter Pence and Grant Brisby on Thursday, supplying your caffeine fix for the week. And then on Friday, heading into the weekend, as always, it's Keith Law and DVR. If you want to read more of Ken and all those other people's great work on The Athletic, go to theathletic.com/baseballshow. Right now, you can sign up for just $3.99 per month. Great stuff, Ken, as always. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Tim.
All right, I'm Tim McMaster. Thanks, and have a great week, everyone.